Thanks for being here, Animal Explorers. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and this hour is devoted to all our creature friends, from the jaguars in the Amazon rainforest to our polar bear friends that call the Arctic Ocean home, to our very own backyard with those curious squirrels and rabbits. You know, those rabbits greet me every morning on my way to work. They hop along next to my bike. I love seeing their bushy tails. What is your favorite animal you're seeing on your walks? Is there some creature you've been wondering about that lives on your street or in your backyard? Tell us about what it does and what it looks like. Also, what do you want to know about caring for pet lizards or hedgehogs? Here's the number to talk. Grown-ups, help us out. 800-642-1234. Ryan McVeigh is executive director of the Madison Area Herpetological Society. So in other words, he loves reptiles, knows a lot about them. Ryan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, it's great to be back. I'm happy to be here this morning.
And we also have Dr. Grayson Doss, who is a clinical assistant professor of zoological medicine at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. He takes care of animals, including animals at the zoo. Dr. Doss, welcome back to you.
Hey, Kate. Thanks for having me on the show again.
Well, we need to clear up one thing right away. Dr. Doss, you love rats. Ryan, you know, you are the snake person here, and snakes eat rats. Is that right, Dr. Doss?
That's true. Some snakes do actually eat rats.
So, Ryan, you know, do snakes swallow their food whole? How do they consume that rat?
Yeah, so they actually dislocate their jaws in two different ways in order to open their mouth up to like three or four times bigger than the width of their body to consume their prey whole. It's pretty cool to see, and it's a really unique adaptation that those animals have.
Do you watch it? Can you see that happening?
Absolutely. With any pet that you have, like pet snakes that you have or anything like that, when you feed them, you can definitely watch that process. And it can be a lot. It can be really quick. So it's actually really cool to see how an animal with no hands or fingers or can eat something so big so fast.
And then do you see the big lump on that snake where that rat is going down?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's one thing. Their body stretches out to handle that, and then within a couple days, they start to digest most of it, so that lump kind of goes away.
Dr. Doss, are there any defenses for those rats against these hungry snakes?
True, yeah. In the wild, you would see rats trying to get away. They'd be running. They're super fast at running, and they're very agile, kind of navigating their environment. They'd also, basically, their main defense would be their teeth. And so they would be able to bite the snake to try and get away and to kind of scare the snake. So that would be their main defense mechanism other than speed.
How sharp are those rat teeth? How do they use their teeth?
Well, their teeth are actually very sharp. They continue to grow throughout their life. And so they have to chew on things. And as they eat their food, they're going to wear down those teeth over time. So they're actually quite sharp. And so that's one thing when you're working with pet rats, you have to be careful because they might give you a little bit of a nibble.
So if they give you a little bit of a nibble, do we know what that means?
True. I mean, pet rats will actually, if they're feeling maybe a little bit stressed or they don't like something, they might kind of put their teeth on your finger to say, hey, stop that. They're actually very smart. And then sometimes, like in the wild, if you're being hunted by a snake, per se, then you could use your teeth to defend yourself. So they are very sharp, and they're kind of designed to be that way to help them break into food items that they're eating.
We're talking with zoo vet Dr. Grayson Doss. He loves rats and hedgehogs, lots of other animals. And we're talking with Ryan McVeigh, who knows a whole lot about reptiles. Animal lovers, pet owners, we want to hear from you. Do you have a pet at home that isn't a cat or a dog? What kind of pet is it? Do you have a rat or a turtle, a snake, maybe a ferret? What is their name? What are they like? And how do they spend their days? We're at 800-642-1234. So, Ryan, tell us the difference between reptiles and amphibians.
Yeah, so reptile, they're both cold-blooded animals, which means that they don't produce their own body heat. They get their heat from their surroundings. So in order to warm up, they have to go somewhere warmer. If they want to cool down, they have to go somewhere colder. Amphibious means living part of its life on land and water, which means that almost all amphibians start out as eggs and then turn into some sort of larval form, like a tadpole. and then they morph into their adult form, which would be like a little frog or a salamander. Reptiles have scales, which amphibians don't, and then they generally are born as a live baby or they hatch out of an egg.
And what kind of reptiles can we find living here in Wisconsin?
Wisconsin has a really awesome reptile diversity, and I think between reptiles and amphibians, there's 56 or 58 species, including, for reptiles, two species of rattlesnakes, and most people don't know, but four species of lizards, one which doesn't actually have legs and looks like a snake.
Ooh, what is that?
So it's called a slender glass lizard. Well, it looks like a snake, but 50% of its body is actually tail. And they can still drop their tail like other lizards in defense. So it's a really unique looking animal. But what makes it not a snake is the fact that it can't dislocate its jaw and it has ear holes.
Well, they're like a transformer, it sounds like. They can transform into other things.
Almost. It's a really unique little cool little animal. And they live around like the central Wisconsin area in some of the sandier areas of the state.
Ooh, so they like sand. Do they burrow down into that sand?
Yeah, absolutely. They build burrows and just a really cool species. It's kind of unique to see them and snakes, animals that don't have legs, be so active and agile, including one snake species we have in the state, the blue racer, can actually move up to 17 miles per hour. It's one of the fastest snakes in the world, and it doesn't have legs. It's super cool. It can outrun you with no legs.
Wow. Dr. Das, why are rats so smart?
I think they've had to, it's a great question. I think over time, they've had to adapt to environments to kind of, you know, be able to increase their population. And so they, one way to do that is to kind of develop certain skills to survive. And I think that has enabled them to move around in an increasingly enlarging human population and to kind of thrive in areas where people thrive, which wouldn't necessarily fit with your more kind of wild rats that are more adapted to forest areas. So I think that has kind of pushed them to become smarter over time. And you compare them to other mammals of similar sizes, they're just very intelligent.
How do you make an interesting habitat for your pet rat?
That's a good question, and a question we hear quite frequently from clients. And I think one thing you can do, because they're so smart, is to always provide them with something to think about and something to solve. And we call that enrichment. And so constantly giving them new toys, they love toys, giving them environments to navigate through, like tunnels and mazes. If you have an enclosure for them, making sure it has multiple levels, gives them room to kind of exercise and explore. And then sometimes food items, just giving them a new food item can help them kind of experience something new. And that can help them kind of develop and kind of really challenges their brain.
Are there any favorite foods or favorite toys that you hear about?
I think each rat is different. They always like treat items, for sure. You think about seeds. So you have to be careful with how many seeds and treats that you feed them, just like with people. And as far as toys, I've come across different things. Some of them like places to hide. Some of them like jingly bells, you know, like you would think a cat would enjoy. And then sometimes they like tunnels and things to run through. So they like quite a few things, and trying to figure out what your rat enjoys is actually a lot of fun.
We're talking with zoo veterinarian Grayson Das and Ryan McVeigh, who is the head of the Madison Area Herpetological Society. And we're talking about all of our creature friends. Do you have a pet at home that isn't a cat or a dog? What kind of pet is it? Maybe you do have a rat or a pet snake or a ferret, a pet lizard. What is their name? What are their days like? How do you interact with them? Share with us, grown-ups too. Here's the number, 800-642-1234. We'll be back faster than a cheetah chasing a gazelle on the Ideas
Network.
If you're just joining us, this hour is devoted to our animal friends that make their homes all around us. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Did you know a raccoon crossed my path this morning? It scurried right down into the storm drain. It poked its head up and said, hello, goodbye. Do you wish you could have a pet, but maybe mom or dad says no? Could we do some research, maybe build a case for you? What do you say? What are your questions about caring for your pet lizard or snake? Does your pet hamster do something silly that makes you laugh? Let's hear all about it. Grown-ups Help, 800-642-1234. Send us your animal email to ideas@WPR.org. We have two experts helping us out. Dr. Grayson Doss is a vet, and he cares for zoo animal friends. And Ryan McVeigh is a reptile lover. He's with the Madison Area Herpetological Society. So, Ryan, you know, if there are kids out there who do want a pet snake or a pet lizard, but, you know, parents say, no, no way, what advice would you give them?
Well, there's two things I tell any kid that wants a reptile as a pet. And one is the best way, I think, to get your parents excited about it is to join the Madison Area Herp Society and as much as you can. But no, we've actually had a lot of parents that when the kids start learning about the reptiles, amphibians, parents end up learning just by association. And then the more they learn, the more they're open to that idea. Plus, when your child is driving so hard to learn so much and taking on all that responsibility, it makes it a lot easier to kind of go, okay, you know, maybe I don't like it, but they really are doing a lot of work and really trying and they're doing their research and they're ready for it. It's a little easier to say yes to that.
And explain that these are pets that are bred in captivity. Is that right?
Most of the time, yes. And that's for a first-time pet. That's the kind you want to get is one that's been bred in captivity, like a bearded dragon or a ball python or a rosy boa. And then making sure that, again, research is so important with reptiles. And the big reason for that, not only just as a pet owner, is because every single reptile you'll see at a pet store comes from totally different places all over the world. And their husbandry requirements and the things that they need to be healthy are all very, very different. And you need to know that for your animal in order to keep it for a long time and keep it happy.
You have to know all about its background and its history. How much time should you spend caring for, you know, that pet lizard? I know it probably varies between a bearded dragon and some type of snake, but what is the upkeep?
Upkeep is probably the most minimal of any pet you could possibly have. When it comes to snakes, you make sure they have clean water, and then they eat once a week and they poop once a week, and you really can't get much easier than that. And bearded dragons or other lizards, they'll go to the bathroom a little more often, so it's a little more upkeep. But then interaction when it comes to taking them out and handling them and working with them can be almost as much as you'd like, as long as you always remember that that habitat you've created is the perfect environment for them. So while you do want to enjoy them and take them out and play with them, that heat and humidity and special lighting that they need doesn't exist outside of their tank. So you need to make sure that they're not out all day, every day.
How, and so you keep a light on them to keep that warmth going. How warm do they need it?
It depends on the species. Some species like crested geckos from New Caledonia in the Pacific Ocean, those guys don't like it any hotter than like 78 degrees. They like it basically about room temperature. And then there's some other species like bearded dragons and some monitors from Australia that like to bask at 150 degrees.
Whoa.
So it depends. But the other important lighting is UV lighting, which is what they get from the sunlight. And almost all reptiles use UV lighting to synthesize vitamin D and use that to metabolize the calcium in their diet. And if they don't do that, they can actually die from it.
We're talking with Ryan McVeigh, who knows a whole lot about reptiles. We also have Dr. Grayson Doss, who is a zoo vet. He loves rats and hedgehogs, lots of other animals. What are your questions about caring for your pet? What do you want to know about reptiles and rats, hedgehogs, other creatures? We're at 800-642-1234 to join in. Dr. Doss, let's talk about those adorable hedgehogs. There's a kind that's called the African pygmy hedgehog. How big do these little guys get?
They usually stay pretty small if you compare them to other hedgehog species, like those that you would see like in Great Britain. They probably get no bigger than you can hold in your hands and maybe up to, you know, not quite up to half a pound. So they stay pretty small. And they certainly are. They make really fun pets.
What do their spikes feel like?
Their spikes are pretty pokey. They're very sharp, but they don't tend to come off really easily like a porcupine would. So if over time, as they kind of get used to you, they don't really raise their spines as much into a protective ball. So they become a little bit more familiar, and then they're less frightened. And so their spines become less pokey over time, I guess.
How can owners keep them happy? How should we care for them?
Sure. Hedgehogs like to exercise in the wild. You know, these are in African species. They will run several miles each day looking for food, and so they stay pretty active. And so when you have a pet hedgehog, you want to focus on providing them enough activity points. So a lot of them like to run in wheels. Like if you think about rats and mice, and they had like running wheels in their cages. And then a lot of them like to explore different environments. And so providing tunnels and different toys for them and different food items can keep them happy for sure.
How common are they as a pet? How often do you care for them?
They're pretty common. I'd say they're not quite as common as, say, pet rabbits, but they're becoming a little bit more popular, and maybe we see as many, at least at the veterinary hospital, as you would say, like rodents, like guinea pigs, or chinchillas. And so I would say they're a pretty common pet.
And so when something like a chinchilla is coming in for a health checkup, how do you approach these animals? What are their checkups like?
Sure. I think a big thing is to make sure the animal is as little stressed as possible, because it's just like if you bring your dog or your cat to the vet. It's a new environment. The car ride's going to be a little scary for them. And so trying to make sure that they feel safe is really important. And then just being very mindful of how you work with them, and just be very careful so to do your exam so you don't frighten them. But sometimes you have to approach it a little bit differently than you would, say, with a dog, a bigger dog, just because they're so small.
I would imagine with these more exotic animals, I'm wondering, are their bodies very different? Is their chemistry a lot different? And do you have to study a lot about how their systems work?
We do. If you go through, say, veterinary medical school, you're going to learn a lot of different things about different species, because when you look at how different a cow is, say, from, you know, a millipede, there's a lot of differences there. So especially when it comes to anatomy. But surprisingly, when you break it down and you look at the physiological processes like red blood cells and how different organs work, there are a lot of similarities between species, even humans. And so that helps when you're trying to learn and trying to find out problems that may exist. But the anatomy certainly is tricky because it's so different.
Well, Ryan, what is your favorite kind of reptile in the whole world?
All of them. I think one of the coolest species that I really enjoy learning about, and I've actually had the privilege to be able to work with, to be able to interact with a few times, it's called a tuatara. It's not a snake or a lizard. It's almost in its own group, and it is in a monotypic order, which means it's the only species in that entire order. It dates almost back to the dinosaurs. It's a super cool lizard-looking animal from New Zealand.
Oh, how cool is that? Dr. Das, if you could choose to be any animal for a day, what animal would you choose?
Oh, man, that's a great question. I would say, maybe some type of eagle. I'd love to fly.
Oh, that's a good one. How about you, Ryan?
Well, with how busy I've been lately, anything that sleeps a lot.
Well, let's take a call now. Richard is with us from Two Rivers. Hi, Richard.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me on the air. Yeah, I've got a couple of reptiles. I have a chameleon that's doing really well, and I picked up a boa constrictor, and I got it in a 30-gallon octagon tank. And I bought from the pet shop the two bulbs. They had one red for at night, and then the other one, the white one, for the day to keep it warm. And I want to have a couple questions. One is, does it get UV from those bulbs? But it is kind of close to a window that gets a lot of sunshine in the morning. And the other thing is, could I feed that boa constrictor small frogs and toads from my yard and crickets and mealworms?
Oh, great questions. Ryan, do you want to field it first?
Yeah, absolutely. So with the light bulbs that you have are just producing heat and light. They don't produce UV light. Luckily, when it comes to snakes, they don't truly need UV. They do benefit from it, but they don't need it. They get most of the vitamins and minerals they need from their prey items. The chameleon, though, absolutely needs UVB or UVB light. And without it, a specific UVB light, and without it, they aren't able to metabolize their calcium, and they generally don't do very well and can get sick very quickly.
Richard, thanks for the call. And Ryan and Dr. Das, thank you so much for being here.
Absolutely. It was fantastic to come on, and I'm happy to talk reptiles anytime.
Ryan.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
That was Dr. Grayson Das, who is a professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Ryan McVeigh, executive director of the Madison Area Herpetological Society. And now I hope you're sitting down, because Wild Krat star Chris Kratt joins us to talk about all the animals he's seen around the world. Join in with your questions for him, 800-642-1234. We'll be back with Chris Kratt right after this news update on the Ideas Network. Uh-huh. Do you recognize that theme music? It's Wild Krats. We're going on adventures with the coolest creatures here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Get ready to talk about the creature powers, because we have a very special guest. Chris Kratt is here. He's one half of the Kratt brothers. Chris and his brother Martin, they go on creature adventures all over the world. And Chris, he really likes spider monkeys these days that are higher up in the tropical rainforest canopy. So what is the coolest creature on our planet? What questions do you have about wildlife you're seeing? What's your favorite Wild Krats episode? Let's talk about it. Here comes the number. Grown-ups help, 800-642-1234. Chris Kratt is one of the stars of Wild Krats on PBS Kids. He's a zoologist, which means he studies all kinds of animals. Chris, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, my gosh. You get this asked a million times. But what do you think is the coolest animal out there?
Oh, I do get asked that a lot. And it is the most difficult question to answer. I mean, I have to say it's usually the animal that I'm with. That I'm with at the moment, or that I've just recently spent a lot of time with. So I guess right now, my answer would be red foxes, because I've been spending a lot of time this spring camped out at a fox den, watching these young foxes, four young foxes, grow up and get fed by their mother and father and play and practice their hunting skills. And they are so cute. And the parents are such good parents, and it's been a real pleasure to kind of get a glimpse into their life.
What does their den look like?
Well, they use, they can use anything. Oftentimes they use like old dilapidated sheds or like mound areas where they dig holes underneath, you know, log piles sheltered away a little bit. And a lot of times they use several different den sites. Like they'll move their kits two or three times as the kits are growing up to different den sites, usually all pretty close, in close proximity to one another. But they tend to, you know, bring in a lot of food for the kits, and, you know, some of it lies around. And so I think partly for cleanliness and to keep, they do have to worry about some predators. So to keep some predators sort of off their trail, they tend to move them slightly.
Well, from fox, we're going to move to lions. Drake is joining us from DeForest with a question. Hi, Drake. What's your question?
Why are lions so loud?
Wild lions. Did you say they roar loudly?
Yeah. Why are lions so loud?
Oh, why are they so loud? Yeah, that's a great question, Drake. Well, they roar. They do these roars, and those roars can usually be heard from 2 miles away. So you're right. They can be really loud. And mainly what they're doing is they're sort of proclaiming their turf. You know, they're kind of saying, this area is my area, and anybody within earshot better stay away and recognize that this is my turf. And so they do that occasionally to sort of stake their claim on their territory.
Drake,
and
they,
also
yeah.
sometimes to gather the rest of the pride together.
Oh, so it can kind of be a rallying cry to say, hey, gang, come in here. We need to talk.
Yeah, it can be that too. Yep.
Drake, thank you for the call. Let's bring in Owen now in Madison. Hi, Owen.
Hi.
What's your question?
Owen. Chris, what's your favorite color of an animal?
Oh, well, I'd have to say, I guess my favorite color of an animal is green, because as you know, I really like green. But one of the things I love is that there are so many colors in nature, and animals have probably become, there are animals that are probably, you know, any color you can think of. We're doing an episode this season, we're working on it. It's about poison frogs. And they come, I don't know if you know about them, sometimes they're called poison arrow frogs or poison dart frogs. They have poisonous skin, that's why they're called that. And they're sometimes called poison dart frogs because some tribes in the Amazon and in South America, they've used the poison from their skin to put on the tips of their arrows when they go hunting, traditionally. But they're super colorful. And one reason they are is to advertise to everybody. This is common in nature. When things are poisonous, they're often brightly colored. So they're advertising to everybody, don't mess with me, because, you know, they try to be a memorable color, because if an animal tries to eat them, they might get sick, and then they'll never try to eat something that color again. But poison frogs come in all different colors, all of the rainbow. They can be purple and blue and yellow and green and red. They're gorgeous.
So how do you get your cameras and your video equipment in there to capture these poison frogs in their glory and in their habitat?
Well, one of the most fun things about filming wildlife is that when you're trying to get good footage and good behavior of the animals, you have to know about them and you have to kind of think like them, and that's the best way to try to get the footage. So we use all kinds of different methods. Sometimes we know where a den is, and we go and we go to the den and we get them comfortable with our presence there so that they go about their normal business, even with us there with our cameras. Sometimes we go to where they like to get food, like a fruiting fig tree. Lots of animals in Asian rainforests, when the fig trees fruit, they gather there for the overabundance of food. And so there are lots of different ways to approach wildlife filmmaking, and that is one of the most fun parts, because you get to kind of think like the animal that you're trying to film.
We're talking with Chris Kratt. He's one of the stars of Wild Kratts, and you could have creature powers. You can talk to us about your creature powers. What would they be? Is there any animal you definitely don't want to be? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Finn now. And Finn is joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Finn.
Hi.
What's your question?
What was the hardest animal to find?
Oh, well, you know, sometimes that's a really good question. The hardest animal to find, I know one of the hardest animals to follow was chimpanzees when we were filming them, because they live in this mountainous part of Africa and Uganda, and we were filming these chimps when they were moving through the forest, looking, actually, this is for a series before Wild Kratts, when they were looking actually for monkeys to hunt, because surprisingly they do that. But we had to, they move fast. They move over mountainous terrain in dense jungles, and it was hard. It was hard to keep up with them with all our gear. We also sometimes have to wait and wait patiently, like when we were filming orcas down in Patagonia, killer whales. We were on this beach where they regularly hunt seals, and you never know when they're going to come by. They have huge territories. They do circuits around their territories looking for food, and we had to wait every day in our blind on the beach for a few weeks. And we weren't, you know, it was getting to be the end of our trip, and we were worried we weren't going to be able to film them. And then on one of the last days of our expedition, they arrived, and it was amazing. We were able to film them and some young orcas. But yeah, you need a lot of patience sometimes too.
Oh, I bet that was just amazing for them to arrive when you had been so patient. Finn, thanks for the question. Let's go to Maya now in Waterford. Hi, Maya.
Hi.
Hi.
Why don't sharks sleep on the bottom of the water?
Yeah, well, some sharks do. Some sharks do. Some sharks are like to hang out near the bottom of the water, and they can lie motionless. Other sharks need to kind of keep moving to get water and oxygen through their lungs. A lot of sea creatures, like dolphins, for example, scientists think they don't really ever, they rest their brain, but they don't really sleep the way we do, because they sort of sleep or rest one side of their brain, and the other side is active, looking for predators and things like that. And then they'll wake up that side of the brain, and they'll give their other side of their brain a rest or a sleep. So it's interesting. Sleep is different for different animals, and we don't really know much. We're still learning a lot about sleep and how animals rest
Maya, what do you like about sharks?
That probably that like some sharks eat killer whales.
Yeah,
some great whites have, but killer whales, orcas, have been seen eating sharks too. So those are two of the apex predators, the biggest, strongest predators in the ocean.
Chris Kratz of Wild Kratz is with us. What animals do you wish you could be if you could have creature powers for a day? I would want to be a giant squid for sure. They have 8 legs, 2 feeder arms. I'm sure they're really good multitaskers. We're at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute. More conversation here on the Ideas Network. We've got Creature Powers here in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and our special guest is Chris Kratz of Wild Kratz on PBS. He's telling us all about the amazing creatures he encounters in our world. And hey, what animals like foxes we may encounter in our own backyard. Let's bring in another call. Helen is joining us from Byron this morning. Hi, Helen.
Hi.
Hi.
Your question.
How are wolves such a great team?
How do wolves work together? Oh, I love it.
That's great. That's a great question and a great owl. Yeah, they work together as a pack. And part of it is, you know, in order to work together, we as humans know this too, you have to have good communication. And wolves have good communication. They have all sorts of ways that they basically talk to each other, whether it's visual cues, you know, different body postures and poses, and they have different vocalizations, sounds they make that say different things to one another, and the howl, kind of like we were talking about with the lion's roar, it kind of brings the pack together, sometimes assembles them before a hunt. And they use their noses too to talk to one another, and different smells and scents. So that's how they kind of coordinate with one another and get along and communicate. And they also live in packs partly because they hunt some of the biggest prey around. Here in North America, they hunt moose and elk and caribou, even some bison sometimes of different sizes. So they need to have a strong, large pack to be able to take down some of these large prey with good defenses.
Helen, thank you for calling. Let's bring in Mira now in Madison. Hi, Mira.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
What makes a rattlesnake rattle?
Oh, yeah, what makes a rattlesnake rattle? That's a great question. Okay, so there's two ways to answer that. The rattle is special scales, you know, like reptiles and snakes and things. They have scales on their bodies, right? And these, the tip of a rattlesnake's tail is special scales that are kind of dried out and loose on the tail. And so when they shake their tail, it makes a sound. And, you know, one of the reasons they do this rattling is because they don't want to bite anybody. So a lot of people are scared of rattlesnakes and they think, oh, they're going to bite me. They want to bite me. But they don't. They don't want to bite you. And so the rattle is a warning saying, hey, back off. You're too close. I'm really scared. I'm really nervous. Please, I'm afraid of you. Back off, or I might have to try to defend myself and bite. So that's real. They don't use the rattle when they're hunting. You know, when they're hunting, they're quiet and they sneak up on their prey and they bite them and use their venom. The rattle is used when they're scared and are asking a predator or a human to back off and leave them alone.
We should be very attentive to that. Mira, thank you. Let's bring in Toby now in Madison. Hi, Toby.
Hi.
Hi.
What do you want to say, bud?
My favorite animal and favorite creature parachute is a Draco lizard.
Your favorite animal is what?
Draco lizard.
A Draco lizard. Oh, yeah. Draco lizards are great. They are lizards that can glide from tree to tree in the Asian jungles. They have flaps of skin under their arms, right? Connecting under their arms to the side of their body. And they can make a big leap and glide through the air to another tree. It's amazing. Different animals can do that. Like here in North America, we have flying squirrels. They use a similar trick. And even in the same forests in Asia, they have flying snakes that have flaps of skin on their sides and can glide from tree to tree.
Wow. So we should look up if we're around those parts. Toby, thank you. Let's bring in Alexis now in Milwaukee. Hi, Alexis.
Hi. I just wanted to let you know that I'm a little bit old for the Wild Kratts now, but I did watch the Boom of Fua every day at 5 o'clock on PBS when I got home from school, and I was just wondering how the Boom of Fua is doing, if you followed him through his life.
Oh, yeah. Zaboomafu, he's doing great. He's doing great. You can still catch episodes where we meet different animal friends at Animal Junction with Zaboomafu. He now has some grandchildren because at Duke Lemur Center there were a few young lemurs that were recently born this spring that are one is the grandchild of Zabu and one is the nephew of Zabu. So he's good. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Alexis,
thank you so much. Now let's go to Colton in Neosha. Hi, Colton.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Yeah, hi.
My question is, why are there so many cicada doom bugs in this time of year?
Did you hear us?
Why are there so many June bugs this time of year?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, summer's a good time for insects. They like to come out in the summer. The weather is good for them. Here in North America in the summer, of course, and there's food because most of, you know, a lot of insects eat plants and rely on plants and things. So, although some, of course, eat other insects and things like that, but they come out. It's a good time for them. The temperatures are good. They can survive. A lot of insects have trouble with the cold weather during the winter, so they do different things, you know, similar to hibernation. They hide away in under bark and some in the ground to get through the winter time. But in the spring, they come out, there's food around, and they're active.
Colton, thank you for the question, and happy summer to you. We have Chris Kratt, one of the stars of the TV show Wild Kratts, when we're talking all about the creature world. Chris, you got to visit a really cool place, the mountains of southern China, and you got to hang out with pandas. What are pandas like?
Oh, yeah. Pandas are amazing and truly, really unique animals. They, first of all, I think a lot of people know that they eat bamboo. And they, well, they're really cute, but they also, they eat this bamboo, and it's a type of plant that a lot of animals can't eat because it has toxins and things in them. So pandas have a special way of doing it. They have special bacteria in their gut that helps them digest this bamboo, which is really hard to digest and poisonous for a lot of animals, but it's hard to get nutrition from it. So they have a really slow metabolism, kind of like sloths, and they have to conserve their energy because it's hard to extract from bamboo. And so that's one of the reasons you see them, you know, you never see them moving very fast, although they can if they want to. But they're kind of often just lying around in cute poses, munching away at bamboo because they have to.
And pandas are endangered. Is there anything we can do to help them?
Well, yeah. I mean, there are different groups working on panda conservation, and you can if you're really interested in pandas, you can look up which groups those are and try to find ways to help pandas specifically. We also have a not-for-profit organization called Kratt Brothers Creature Heroes, and what we're doing is empowering kids and families and people who love animals to be creature heroes by finding ways to help animals. And one of our first projects was to create a wildlife refuge here in North America. And we polled a bunch of kids and found out what animal kids wanted to help, and they wanted to help grizzly bears.
Mm.
So we made a grizzly bear refuge, which protects critical grizzly bear habitat, as well as a lot of other animals that live there and rely on it. And now we're really excited because we're embarking on creating our second Kratt Brothers Creature Refuge. That's what we call our wildlife refuges.
Wow, that is so cool. Chris, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. It was really fun talking with you, Kate, and really good questions coming in from kids. So thanks Chris, everybody out there.
Chris Kratt, his brother Martin, they're the Wild Kratts on PBS Kids. And earlier we talked with a zoo vet and a reptile expert. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have no shortage of creature powers here on the Ideas Network.